Short Rounds.
Hey, y'all, and welcome back to the Unknown Soldiers podcast. I am your host, James Hauser. What you're about to hear is another short round. For new listeners, this is a shorter episode. They're getting less short, but still a shorter episode that tackles a smaller subject or serves as a supplement to a larger series. Today's short round is a supplement to the Soviet-Afghan War series, hence the title Soviet-Afghan War Part 1.5. Today, we're getting a thorough and necessary introduction to one of the two sides of that conflict, the Soviet military. As for the other portion of the title, for those of you who don't know, because some of you might not, the bear is a commonly used symbol for Russia or the Soviet Union. The same way that the bald eagle is often used to represent America, the bear is used to represent Russia / the Soviet Union. This episode is necessary for a few reasons. First, to get rid of some misconceptions. The Soviet army that invaded Afghanistan was not the Soviet army of World War II, and it was not the modern Russian army. It certainly had things in common with both of those, but there were big differences. Second, introduce a lot of lingo and concepts and pieces of equipment that will come up frequently in the series. I don't want to have to explain over and over and over what this vehicle was or that aircraft is or who the VDV and Spetsnaz were. Finally, because the Soviet military was trained and organized to fight a certain way by a certain doctrine. This was partially based on their most likely opponents, the U.S. Army and its NATO allies. But the Soviet military was also designed in accordance with Marxist ideology. What they saw was a logical, objective, scientific way of war that guaranteed victory. But when the rubber hit the road, the Soviet way of war would be found wanting. Even the mightiest bear can stumble. As always, this is not just history, but military history, so there's some dark and bloody stuff going on. This podcast is PG-13. The language is clean, the content is not. A small content warning, there will be some mention of sexual assault in today's episode. Not gonna belabor the fact, but there is some mention of it. Second, all my sources will be posted on my website, unknownsoldierspodcast.com, in the big Soviet-Afghan War source post, so if you want to fact-check me, feel free to do so. Finally, any errors, mispronunciations, or mistakes are my own. I'm trying to be entertaining, but all the information I'm giving you is accurate to the best of my knowledge. This was a real story with real people who don't deserve to be unknown soldiers. The Soviet military that invaded Afghanistan was the product of four major influences. First, the Russian military tradition. The Soviet army of the late Cold War inherited many characteristics, both good and bad, of previous Russian and Soviet militaries, like an emphasis on quantity over quality, amassing of firepower, sweeping maneuver. Tactics are often clumsy, based on brute force rather than finesse. Not subtle is the Russian army. The Russians have great artillery and engineering branches, but their logistics and medical services are lacking. A good officer corps, but a weak NCO corps, and very poor treatment of the common soldier. But the common soldier is also famously resilient, performing well in even the worst conditions. Again, these are general qualities in Russian and Soviet militaries throughout history. They have varied from time to time based on the era. Sometimes the Russian military is better, sometimes it's worse. But compared to its historical counterparts, like, say, Tsar Nicholas's army in the Crimean War, or Stalin's army in World War II, or Putin's army in Ukraine, man for man, Brezhnev's army in Afghanistan was probably the best of all of them. Not saying it was good, but quality-wise, the Soviet army that invaded Afghanistan was one of the best militaries Russia or the Soviet Union has ever fielded. Second major influence, the ideology of Marxism-Leninism. The Soviet soldier served a socialist empire. Every aspect of military life was supervised by the Communist Party, inundated with socialist ideology. This shaped everything from the life of the common soldier all the way up to military doctrine and policy. Third, the legacy of the last war. For the Soviets, the last war they'd ever fought, was World War II, or as they called it, the Great Patriotic War. Many senior Soviet generals who served in Afghanistan or during the Soviet-Afghan War had fought in World War II as junior officers, and countries often enter a new war trying to fight the last one. In some ways, the Soviets would be trying to refight World War II in Afghanistan. Of course, what worked on the Nazis would not work on the Mujahideen. Finally, the shadow of the next war. The big one. Apocalypse. Doomsday. Nuclear war. World War III. The Soviets were not just preparing for World War III, they believed it was inevitable, and they wanted to win. And that meant preparing for one opponent on one battlefield. The US Army and its NATO allies on the plains of Northern Europe. The Soviet military was fine-tuned to defeat this exact opponent on this exact battlefield. This was the next war they planned to fight. This was the war they planned to win. Everything, their weapons, their tactics, their training, their doctrine, their policy, revolved around winning this particular war in this specific scenario. If the Soviets had a second possible opponent, it was the People's Republic of China. One crazy thing about the Cold War is that Communist China and the Communist Soviet Union were not friends. They were rivals. The Sino-Soviet split, it was called. They even fought a small war along the Manchurian-Siberian border in 1969. A leftist has no greater enemy than another leftist. The Soviets didn't expect to fight World War III with China, but they couldn't ignore the threat they posed. So that was the task of the Soviet military in the Cold War. Prepare for World War III against the West, and keep an eye on China just in case. Afghanistan is not in this job description. Why would we fight a war there? The Soviet armed forces were divided into five branches compared to the traditional Western three. The traditional ones are the Army, Navy, and Air Force. The Soviets had all those. The Strategic Rocket Forces, the Nuclear Missile Forces, which in America are under the Air Force, were their own branch in the Soviet Union. Then there was a special branch called the National Air Defense, which commanded heavy anti-aircraft units, civil defense, and its own fighter aircraft squadrons. Weird that there's an entire branch for air defense, right? Almost like it's a priority. Like they were preparing to fight the most powerful air force in the world, hypothetically. I wonder who that could be. We will be focusing on the Soviet Army today with some discussion of the Air Force. The other three branches were not involved in the Soviet-Afghan War, famously few oceans in Afghanistan for the Navy to splash around in. The Mujahideen had no aircraft for the Soviets to fight with their air defense, and the Strategic Rocket Forces, they're not going to nuke Afghanistan. So that's three of the branches that are just not going to be involved in this war. So it's mainly a show for the Soviet Army with the support of the Soviet Air Force. Note that the Soviet Army had been called the Red Army of Peasants and Workers, or just the Red Army, during World War II, but it was renamed to the Soviet Army in 1947. This is a pet peeve of mine. It's how you can tell someone writing about this war didn't do their research if they keep referring to the Soviets as the Red Army, including several very popular books I've read on this war. No, in this war it was the Soviet Army. It had been that for 30 plus years. The five branches reported to the Defense Ministry, which was a whole beehive of committees and councils and sub-ministries. It's not productive for us to get into this. But I do have to point out one thing. The Defense Ministry oversaw about a dozen smaller branches called the Special Troops. Not Special Forces, Special Troops. These were the Engineer, Chemical, Signal, Logistics, Railroad, Ordnance, all those kind of branches. The Special Troops are your rear area troops, your logistics guys. There were also the Border Guards, which fell under the KGB, and the Interior Army, the security troops for the gulags and military bases. They fell under the State Police Force, or MVD. So there's a lot of weird duplication of effort going on here. The Soviet military was like everything in the Soviet Union, absolutely choked with a massive, redundant bureaucracy. The Special Troops do a lot of work in Afghanistan. So do the KGB Border Guards. They end up occupying a lot of northern Afghanistan at certain points. The military's high command, their Pentagon, was the Soviet General Staff. In 1979, the chief of the General Staff was Marshal of the Soviet Union Nikolai Ogarkov. He was succeeded in 1984 by his deputy, Marshal of the Soviet Union Sergei Akhromayev. These guys were both World War II veterans, and they were the top military officers throughout the Soviet-Afghan War. Ironically, they told the Soviet leaders that the war was a terrible idea and they should not do it. They knew that an army built for mass maneuver warfare in Northern Europe was not really prepared to fight a guerrilla war in Afghanistan. Right before the 2 weeks before the invasion, Marshal Ogarkov made a last-ditch effort to talk the Soviet leaders out of war. He warned that if the Soviets invaded,
"We will consolidate the entire Islamic world against us and alienate the whole world politically.
Ogarkov said this to the Soviet leaders, and Yuri Andropov, the KGB head, chewed him out. He said,
"Stick to military affairs. We, the party, and Comrade Brezhnev will decide policy."
Then he was probably like, "Hey, somebody change Comrade Brezhnev's diaper." These guys presided over what was probably the largest peacetime military in human history. The Soviet military was colossal. At the time, in 1979, the US military had 2 million on active duty. The Soviets had 5 million on active duty in 1979. And at the base of this colossal mechanized nuclear juggernaut was the conscript. The Soviet Union was a mass conscription country, where every male citizen who could was expected to do his time in the service. The Constitution of the USSR said,
"Military service is the sacred obligation of Soviet citizens."
And those Soviet citizens were raised in a highly militarized society. There were martial youth societies like the Young Pioneers, sort of Boy Scouts but for war. Teenagers joined the All-Union Leninist Communist Youth Organization, aka the Komsomol. High schoolers underwent military training over the summer, where they learned drill and ceremony and rifle marksmanship. This is not JROTC, this is mandatory. This is everybody. Young Soviet men were eligible for conscription at the age of 18. Conscripts were obliged to serve a term of 2 years, and it was really hard to get out of this. Only 12% of Soviet men escaped the draft altogether. That means, 88% of Soviet men went through the army. You had to be disabled or the sole provider for a family to get out of it. But conscription was generally tolerated as a rite of passage to adulthood. Most young Soviet men believed, on some level, in the Soviet dream, the glory of Soviet arms, and the socialist ideal. Some of them didn't, but that's every society. Soviet women also served in the military more on a volunteer basis. They were only 1% of the military, but they did serve. And I will deal with Soviet women's experiences in a separate short round down the road. Again, there's going to be a Women of the Soviet-Afghan War episode focusing on both Soviet and Afghan women. Just know that yes, there are women in this army, but not many, and we will talk about them down the road. The Soviet conscript had zero choice of branch or duty station. There was no, I think I'll join the Air Force. No, you would be told where you're going. Well, usually. Well-connected Soviet families, top party officials or bureaucrats or elites, could pull some strings and slip someone a few rubles to get their kids into the cushy jobs, like the air defense or missile troops. This would intensify during the Afghan War, when parents wanted to keep their kids out of combat. So the soldiers who went to Afghanistan were disproportionately rural or working class. One Soviet general sarcastically said that they should bring back the old name for the army, the Workers' and Peasants' Army. Socialist societies aren't supposed to have a class system, but stuff happens. How's that working out? If this is reminding you of Vietnam, that's a good instinct. The USSR did not send its fortunate sons to Afghanistan. Then there was the ethnic factor. The Soviet leadership considered certain ethnicities to be more reliable than others. The Russians, of course, were the most reliable. One rung below them were the Ukrainians and Belarusians, the other Slavs. But Baltic peoples, Caucasian peoples, Central Asian Muslims, Siberians, and as always the Jews were considered unreliable ethnicities, supposedly less loyal and less capable than the Slavs. There was a hint of truth to this, sort of like a backward sort of truth to this. Lots of these minorities were not thrilled to be part of the Soviet Empire, and the backwater republics had lower education standards. Lots of conscripts arrived to their units from these areas, not even speaking Russian. There was this horrible accident in East Germany in 1988 called the Forstzenna rail disaster. A Soviet tank driver who was a Kazakh, who barely spoke Russian at all, misheard an order from his Russian-speaking commander and got his tank stuck on the train tracks. A train hit the tank, killing 6 people and causing a major diplomatic incident. But this racial stereotyping was also just good old-fashioned racism, especially against the Central Asians. The Muslims always get shat on in the Russian army. A common epithet for them was chok or churka, which meant something like tiny dick or yellow ass. One Soviet veteran said,
"You could never trust the choks. We had some of them lying around, but the real work was always done by the Russians and the Ukrainians."
And the Soviet military sent its men to units based on whether or not they were a reliable or unreliable ethnicity. The combat jobs, the high-tech jobs, the prestigious jobs were disproportionately Russian and Slavic, even though Russians were only 50% of the population of the Soviet Union. The strategic missile forces were almost exclusively Russian. The Army Officer Corps was 85% Russian. Combat arms units were mostly Slavic. But the special troops, the support personnel, all the logistics and, you know, construction and transport guys, were around 80% non-Slavic. They were the ethnic dumping ground of the army. So yeah, in many ways, the Soviet military was the last of the old imperial armies, with its class hierarchies and racial segregation. The new Soviet conscript would undergo 4 weeks of basic training, a very short period compared to Western armies. Then he would go to his unit, his home, for the next 2 years. And his term of service would absolutely blow. The life of a Soviet conscript was dull, bleak, and miserable. Every day was filled with mind-numbing drills and pointless tasks and random abuse. Soldiers had very little free time. Leave was basically a fantasy. A common saying in the USSR was,
"Life is a book, and the army is two pages torn out of it."
The conscript's living conditions were downright primitive. He was paid 4.3 rubles, about $20.85 in modern U.S. money, per month. So basically nothing. Army rations were bland and insufficient. They never got enough food. Most conscripts remembered hunger, constant hunger, as a core memory of their time in service. And the barracks were usually barren huts with no comforts and miserable hygiene standards. There's lots of stories of heaters that didn't work and stoves with no fuel during the Russian winter. Diseases that would be unheard of in a Western army were big problems in the Soviet army, like dysentery, sometimes even cholera. One conscript remembered,
"Conscription is literally hell. For those of us who knew what we could expect, it was the lowest circle of the inferno."
And remember, this is before they went to Afghanistan, where it would get worse. The poor living condition of the average soldier is a historical problem in Russian-Soviet militaries, just across the board. Another historical problem is the lack of a strong NCO corps. NCOs, non-commissioned officers, that is, the sergeants and sergeants major. In Western armies, NCOs are, supposed to be, experienced enlisted soldiers who enforce discipline, train the newbies, and carry out the orders of their officers. And historically, Russian and Soviet armies do not have these guys. They had people with the rank of sergeant, but most Soviet sergeants were just regular old 2-year conscripts with an additional 6 months training and some specialization. A machine gunner, a commo guy, a vehicle driver. No, they were not trained in leadership. They were trained in a certain task. So Soviet NCOs were basically just big privates that knew how to use a radio or drive a tank. They might be squad leaders, especially in the infantry units, but even then, they were basically helpless without an officer to give them orders. The senior NCOs, the sergeants major, were not much better. They were usually people who had re-enlisted after their 2-year term of conscription was over. And if you're re-enlisting in this, that means you can't do anything else outside of this, because literally no job in the Soviet military was worse than the job of a conscript. So if you're walking around like, "Well, I can't really do anything else, I better re-enlist," then you're not high human material. The Soviets did add a new kind of leader in the early 1970s to their military, the praporchik, aka the warrant officer. And these guys were an improvement. They were pretty effective. They had more training than the sergeants, but they weren't as isolated as the officers. They quickly gained the aura of the wise old professional soldier that belonged to the NCO in Western armies. Lots of stories out of the Afghan War of very talented, very, you know, well-respected praporchiks. They were a positive addition to the Soviet military, but there weren't that many of them in 1979. The officers were the ones who kept the whole thing running, and the Soviet officer corps was very serious and professional. It automatically absorbed the most capable men in the Soviet Union, and Soviet officer training was very high quality. There were efficiency reports and career paths and rigorous officer schools and examinations and an up-or-out promotion policy, much like the modern U.S. Army. Military officers were one of the highest paid professions in the USSR. A first rank lieutenant made more than like a senior shop foreman or factory, you know, employee. Each Soviet battalion had an officer slot with no equivalent in the West, the political officer. This guy was like the unit chaplain, but for socialism. Conscripts got a lecture from the political officer every morning in large blocks of political training twice a week during the day. The lectures focused on current affairs, Marxist ideology, and their duties as good socialist brethren in the struggle against world capitalism. I imagine this got old fast. The conscripts were like, yeah, yeah, the motherland this, the proletariat that, can we go to chow, please? The political officer was also responsible for morale, and sometimes even, like, counseling or mental or, you know, therapy. Fun fact, the modern Chinese military, the PLA, still has political officers. But in 2025, they function as something closer to the unit HR guy than the dogmatic socialist maniac of World War II movies. There was a very large gap between how the officers and the enlisted were treated in the Soviet Army, much larger than in Western armies. This was reflective of the corruption and decay of the Brezhnev era. Rank had its privileges, and it was blatant. The officers were seen as a separate class, entitled to more comfort and privileges than the enlisted. There's always a subconscious element of this in every army, even in the best Western armies, but in the Soviet Union, it was blatant. For instance, there's this mantra in the US Army of leaders eat last, meaning that leaders take care of their men's needs before their own. That is an article of faith in Western armies. In the Soviet Army, it was leaders eat first. Literally, officers were specifically rationed more and better food than the enlisted. There was also this increasing problem of corruption and abuse within the officer corps during the late Brezhnev era of stagnation. Some of the scummier officers liked to sell army supplies and equipment on the black market, the second economy. Some officers even hired out their soldiers to work in the fields on weekends to supplement their rations or make a quick buck. This problem was getting worse in the 1980s and would get drastically worse after the fall of the Soviet Union. Granted, this wasn't all officers. There would be very high-quality officers who led their men in the Soviet-Afghan War. We'll see several of them throughout the series. Another increasing problem was alcohol abuse. The Russians have always been stereotypically heavy drinkers. In Russian culture, excessive drinking is associated with masculinity. But in the later Brezhnev era, alcohol consumption rose dramatically. Like, you can see over the 1960s and 70s, alcohol consumption ticking up in the Soviet Union. From being, oh, that's a funny stereotype, to being a no-shit problem. In 1980, the average Soviet citizen drank 8.7 liters of ethyl alcohol a year. That's a staggering amount. For comparison, the average U.S. citizen today drinks 2.5 liters of ethyl alcohol a year, the average person. So the average Soviet citizen was drinking almost 3.5 times as much as a modern American on average. This was bad. Alcohol consumption began to eat away at the military, too. Technically, conscripts weren't permitted to drink alcohol. There were actually laws against giving conscripts alcohol, but soldiers find a way. Some soldiers bought skanky moonshine called Samagon from local farmers. Others distilled alcohol from cheap perfume. Some of them stole military chemicals and fuel and distilled alcohol from that. This caused obvious health problems among the conscripts. Alcoholism was even worse among the officers, who had constant access to liquor and drank fearsomely. And alcoholism, corruption, and the low status of the common soldier all contributed to the Soviet Army's worst problem, the Dedovshchina. The Dedovshchina was a program of hazing perpetrated by the senior conscripts against the junior conscripts. Dedovshchina translates as rule of the old timers or rule of the grandfathers. This referred to the Ded, the grandfather, or also called a Dembel, a conscript in his last few months of service. So the Dedovshchina was the tradition of Dembels or Deds, the senior conscripts, the guys who were had a year or some months in, asserting their superiority over the new recruits. And this went way beyond some barracks hooliganism or even like Full Metal Jacket style basic training stuff. This was systematic humiliation. In some units, this was limited to forcing the new arrivals to serve the Dembels, do their chores, shine their shoes, etc. There might be some mild bullying and harassment. That's not good, but in other units, it got dark. Conscripts could be robbed of their clothes and their food and their pay, ritually demeaned and emasculated. There were beatings, savage beatings, to remind them of their place, and these beatings were occasionally lethal. At its nastiest, Dedovshchina involved torture, including sexual torture and anal rape. The Dedovshchina was a new thing. There had been bullying in the Tsarist army and the World War II era Red Army, but this really psycho business started in the late 1960s. This coincided with a big change Brezhnev introduced to Soviet conscription laws. This allowed the conscription of Soviet citizens with a criminal history, which had been previously forbidden. This was due to A, Brezhnev's big military buildup, and B, the demographic consequences of World War II, meaning the shortage of conscripts. But what this did was bring a bunch of hardened criminals into the Soviet army. A lot of former Gulag prisoners, too, who had been brutalized by the system and were looking to do some brutalization of their own. Lots of the Dedovshchina rituals originated from prison or Gulag rituals. So yeah, this was a bad idea. The Dedovshchina had obviously dire consequences for morale. Many soldiers broke under the pressure. They deserted or self-harmed or committed suicide. But most of them toughed it out, knowing that someday they would be the grandfathers, and they would get to do unto others what had been done unto them. There were those who defended the Dedovshchina. Not the worst bits, of course. You can't really justify the whole anal rape thing, no matter what the Spartans might tell you. But they defended the idea of the Dedovshchina as necessary. Without a strong NCO corps, with their officers being careless and inattentive and often drunk, it fell to the older conscripts to enforce discipline within their units, and they saw this as the only way. One recruit who served in Afghanistan, Andrei Ponomarev, remembered curling up and crying in a corner after his first beating by the grandfathers. He and his friends swore that they would never be like that, but when he became a grandfather, Ponomarev realized that the new soldiers didn't listen to him unless he roughed them up a little bit. And in life or death situations like Afghanistan, the newbies needed to listen to their grandfathers. Dedovshchina was a horribly corrosive influence that represented the decline of the Brezhnev-era Soviet army. It got worse after the Soviet collapse, and it is still a hideous problem in the Russian army today. So yeah, your term of service in the Soviet army was not going to be a trip to Disneyland. But enough about all that depressing stuff. Let's talk about the fun stuff. I know what you nerds have been waiting for. Let's talk about some weapons and vehicles. Most Soviet soldiers carried some version of the iconic Kalashnikov. The AK-47 is probably the most famous and most popular firearm in the world. The AK and its variants are cheap, they are simple, they are user-friendly, they are famously reliable. The AK-47 is an assault rifle, meaning it has selective fire. It can fire either semi-automatic or automatic. The AK's magazine holds 30 rounds of 7.62 ammunition. It has an effective range of 350 meters, and its automatic fire rate is 600 rounds a minute. You'll see debates forever, to the end of time, over whether the AK-47 or the M16 is a better weapon. But there's something you need to understand about this. The AK reflects the Soviet approach to warfare. Mikhail Kalashnikov designed it for the average Soviet soldier, a poorly educated conscript who doesn't do a lot of marksmanship training, but still needs an effective, idiot-proof weapon. Compared to the American M16 and M4 family, the AK is cheaper, easier, and simpler. But the M16 is more accurate, more customizable, with a longer range and a lighter recoil. The AK's selector switch, the safety switch, goes from safe directly to automatic, then to semi-automatic. The M16 goes from safe to semi-automatic to automatic. The AK is made for volume of fire. The M16 is made for precision. Quantity, mass, and simplicity over quality, precision, and complexity. Soviet versus American approaches to warfare. It's pointless to argue over which one is better. They are better for different things. These were weapons designed for certain cultures of warfare. Very few Soviet soldiers in 1979 carried the original AK-47. The AK design has gone through multiple improvements over the decades, notably the AKM, a slightly improved version that is basically indistinguishable from the original 47. There were more AKMs made than AK-47s, so most of the AKs you see in movies, in museums, and the hands of scary people on CNN are probably AKMs. Most of the Soviet Afghan allies, the DRA Army, and most of the Mujahideen carried the older AK-47 or AKM. Most Soviet soldiers carried the AK-74. This was chambered for 5.45 instead of 7.62, so it was a smaller, lighter round that gave it better range and accuracy and enabled the Soviet soldier to carry more ammo. The value of the AK-74 is proven by the fact that the Mujahideen went out of their way to capture AK-74s instead of the original 47s. Another common variant was the AKS-74, a shorter version with a folding metal stock designed for airborne troops. The Soviet infantry squad consisted of 8 or 9 men, mostly armed with AK-74s. 2 men per squad carried a light machine gun. This was usually the PK, a general-purpose belt-fed machine gun chambered for 7.62. The PK's American equivalent would be something like the Vietnam-era M60 or modern M240. The other light machine gun the Soviets used was the RPK, which just looks like an AK-47 on steroids. It's got a much longer barrel and a much longer magazine. The Soviets also had a heavy machine gun, the 14.5mm DSHK or Dushka. Like its equivalent, the American Browning 50 cal, the heavy Dushka was usually mounted on some vehicles. One man in each infantry squad also carried the other iconic Soviet weapon, the RPG-7. The RPG-7 is a rocket-propelled grenade launcher, RPG rocket-propelled grenade, firing an 85mm high-explosive anti-tank round. The rocket can fly about 900 meters, though you're not going to actually hit anything farther away than 300 meters. After that, it just sort of starts spinning around. It's a crapshoot. The RPG has also been used all over the world, just like the AK. It is pretty effective against most armored vehicles. It knocked out Israeli tanks in the Arab-Israeli wars and American tanks in the Vietnam War. The RPG is less useful against aircraft due to its short range and lack of a guidance system, but it is still dangerous. The Americans learned this in 1993 when Somali militants with RPG-7s brought down 3 UH-60 Black Hawk helicopters during the Battle of Mogadishu. This was the famous Black Hawk Down incident. The RPG would be commonly used by both sides in Afghanistan. The Soviets learned to fear any bush that might conceal a Mujahideen warrior carrying an RPG-7. One man per platoon, so one man for every 3 squads, carried the SVD Dragunov, a sniper rifle, and another man carried an anti-air missile launcher, usually the SA-7 Grail. Of course, the Soviets weren't fighting enemy aircraft in Afghanistan. The Mujahideen were notably short of jet fighters, so these didn't see much use. The sniper rifle was very useful. The newest Soviet infantry weapon in Afghanistan was the AGS-17, a tripod-mounted grenade launcher that fired 30mm grenades from a 30-round drum, similar to the U.S. Army's Mark 19. The AGS was heavy, it took 2 men to carry, but it could be devastating in a firefight. Yeah, it's a freaking automatic grenade launcher, you don't want to be in front of that. So those were the weapons of the Soviet infantry. And because Soviet weapons were frequently captured in ambushes or raids, they were also the main weapons of the Mujahideen. So both sides in this war are basically using the same small arms. But what the Mujahideen didn't have access to was the Soviet Army's roster of armored vehicles. The Soviet Army was at heart a mechanized army, a massive armored juggernaut aimed at the forces of the United States and its NATO allies on the North German plain. The formations that made up this juggernaut were the motor rifle divisions and the tank divisions. Each of them was a combination of tanks, mechanized infantry, artillery, and supporting arms. The main difference between the motor rifle and tank divisions is, like, the motor rifle divisions had more infantry, the tank divisions had more tanks. It's what it says on the can. The Soviets had about 122 motor rifle divisions and 60 tank divisions in the 1980s. Yes, this is a massive force, but a lot of these units were reserve units, kept at 50% or even like 10% strength in peacetime, so like skeleton units. In the event of war, the USSR would mobilize its reservists to fill up these units. The full-strength units, the ones that were always 100% strength, were almost all deployed in Europe facing off against NATO, or in the East facing against China. The infantry were mounted on armored personnel carriers, or APCs, armored vehicles designed to carry infantry into battle. There were two types of APCs in the Soviet Army, the BTR and the BMP. What's the difference? The BTR has wheels, the BMP has tracks. That's the difference. To compare them to American vehicles, the BTR is the Soviet version of the Stryker, the BMP is the Soviet version of the Bradley. The BTR is a long, eight-wheeled armored vehicle with a small turret carrying a heavy Dushka machine gun. The BTR-60 was the most commonly used model in Afghanistan. And guys, the BTR sucked. This thing was a turd. The armor was extremely thin, easily punctured by even light machine guns. Do you want some armor on your armored personnel carrier? The BTR-60 was also cramped. It could theoretically carry 14 soldiers, but this was a fantasy. The real number was 8. The troops had to enter and exit through tiny hatches in the roof, which was a problem if the engine caught fire, which happened all the time, or if bullets penetrated the armor, which happened all the time. The Soviets did try to improve on this design. The BTR-70 added a door between the wheels on each side. When I was learning about Soviet vehicles in the U.S. Army, a lot of my sergeants would look at it and say, that's a stupid door, why is that there? Yeah, it looks stupid, but that's a huge improvement from climbing out through those tiny hatches in the roof. The BTR-80, introduced in 1985, so it sees the last half of the Soviet-Afghan War, added more armor and a larger turret with an automatic 30mm cannon. Much more useful. Now, you can polish a turd, but it's still a turd. All the BTR models were flimsy, poorly armored death traps. It was designed to be cheap and simple and easy to produce. It wasn't designed to be good, like any product from a Soviet factory. The BMP series was better. The BMP-1 was a revolutionary design in the 1960s. This was the first infantry fighting vehicle, a tracked APC with a gun turret designed to fight alongside tanks. The infantry fighting vehicle concept would be imitated worldwide, with the American version being the Bradley. The BMP-1 revolutionized the design. The Bradley was the American response to that. The BMP-1 had a crew of 3, driver, gunner, commander, and could carry 8 soldiers who entered and exited the vehicle via rear doors. The turret wielded a short-barreled 73mm gun alongside a machine gun, plus an AT-3 wire-guided anti-tank missile launcher. The cannon was a good weapon for infantry support, but the anti-tank missile was borderline useless. You were lucky if you hit the side of a barn door with this thing. The BMP was designed for the nuclear battlefield. Soldiers sat inside the vehicle on 2 benches back-to-back, shielded from radiation by the armored hull, able to fire their weapons through firing ports in the side. The BMP was impervious to small arms fire, but it could still be destroyed by anti-tank weapons like the RPG, or by mines or roadside bombs. A mine would kill everyone inside, so soldiers preferred to ride on top of the BMP and the BTR. You'll see bunches of photos from this war of soldiers preferring to ride on top of the vehicle so if it gets blown up from underneath, they are shielded from the blast. The driver was dead meat no matter what. The BMP-1's main problem in Afghanistan was that its 73mm gun could not elevate high enough to hit targets on the steep mountainsides. The Soviets had never anticipated their guns would have to elevate that high. This would be rectified with the BMP-2, which wielded a 30mm automatic cannon with a much higher elevation. The Soviet Motor Rifle Division consisted of one motor rifle regiment mounted on BMPs and two motor rifle regiments mounted on BTRs, along with a tank regiment and an artillery regiment. Each motor rifle regiment consisted of three motor rifle battalions and its own tank battalion. The Soviet Army was a very tank-heavy force. Soviet tactics in their Soviet doctrine in battle revolved around the tank. It was their primary weapon system. The most advanced tanks, the T-64 and T-72, never went to Afghanistan. They were reserved for the elite tank divisions stationed in Europe. The tank units in Afghanistan fielded the older T-54/T-55 series or the T-62. The T-54-55 series tank is the most produced tank in history. It's like the archetypal tank, the basic tank. If you asked AI to design a tank for you, this would be it. Four-man crew, 100mm rifled main gun, with a coaxial machine gun and the Dushka heavy machine gun mounted on the roof for anti-air defense. It was a great tank for the 1950s, but by the 80s it was pretty obsolete. The T-54 and T-55 are basically identical, just some minor improvements. It's not important, the differences. The T-62 had a bigger 115mm gun, and it could be modernized with night vision devices, a ballistic computer, and a missile system that could be launched through the gun tube. Not that that made much difference in Afghanistan. Better anti-tank capabilities don't do you much good when your enemy has no tanks. Now, the T-55 and T-62 were not cutting edge in the 1980s. In American first production, M1 Abrams eats these guys for lunch. But they were adequate for their job in Afghanistan, a guerrilla war against an enemy with no tanks at all. The problem was that tanks just weren't that useful in Afghanistan. It wasn't their kind of war. The terrain didn't fit them. They couldn't maneuver in the narrow valleys and steep mountainsides. They couldn't find their targets the same way infantry could. The Soviets still used them because they had so many of them, might as well use them. You go to war with the army you have. But Afghanistan was always more of an infantry war. The Soviets had a whole mess of armored vehicles besides their tanks and APCs. Like, a whole model builder's wet dream of armored cars and engineer vehicles and so forth that we could go into forever. It's not productive. One vehicle that was accidentally useful in Afghanistan was the ZSU-23-4. This was a tracked vehicle with a turret mounting four 23mm automatic cannons in like a square formation, hence the ZSU-23-4. It was supposed to be an anti-aircraft vehicle designed to shoot down enemy helicopters and stuff, but a quad-barreled autocannon is really useful against ground targets, especially unarmored infantry. The Mujahideen hated these things. Besides the tank and infantry units, Soviet divisions had all the usual supporting arms, the artillery, the engineers, reconnaissance units, etc. Recon units were considered the elite units within the mechanized divisions. They were supposed to be the tip of the spear into combat. The Soviet Army also had a lot of artillery. The artillery branch is a historic strong point of the Russian and Soviet Army, one of the things they have always done very well. Soviet artillery was usually mechanized, tracked vehicles mounting heavy guns. For instance, the 2S3 Akatsia, which carried a 152mm howitzer, or the 2S7 Malka with a 203mm gun. The Soviets also had a smorgasbord of rocket artillery, including upgraded models of the famous Katyusha from World War II. These were trucks with rocket racks mounted on the bed. Each rocket rack could hurl a dozen high-explosive rockets at faraway targets. So just blow off the side of the mountain. Yeah, the Russians have a lot of artillery. They always have a lot of artillery. Chemical units also took part in combat operations. This might surprise those of you who have been in a Western military and see the chemical branch as strictly Seaburn-related. like, you know, they deal with chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, like, contamination. That's the job of chemical branches in most Western armies. But in the Soviet army, the chemical units operated the incendiary weapons. These were the RPO and RPOA, man-portable shoulder-fired rocket launchers that fired thermobaric incendiary rounds into targets. Very useful for clearing bunkers, or the Kerez irrigation tunnels used by the Mujahideen. Soviet logistics, by contrast, are a historic weak point. They tended to get a lower priority in resources and training than the combat units. We've already talked about how these branches got all the ethnicities the Soviet Army considered unreliable, but all those things I described that sucked about the Soviet Army, they sucked worse in the logistics units. The racial groups, which, you know, the whole smorgasbord of Soviet racial groups, tended to section themselves off. The Armenians with the Armenians, the Chechens with the Chechens, the Tajiks with the Tajiks. So God help you if you were a Latvian stuck with a bunch of Kazakhs. It was going to be a long 2 years for you. The Soviets fielded a few units that were not part of the heavy mechanized force. First were the Vozdushno-Desantnye Vojska, or VDV, the airborne forces, the paratroopers. Famous for their blue and white striped undershirts, the VDV had a swagger that most other Soviet units lacked. Unlike paratroopers in the West, they were fully mechanized, with their own little handful of armored vehicles usually dropped by helicopter. These included the BMD, miniature BMPs with little elbow room and even less armor. By the 1980s, most Soviet airborne units were helicopter-borne, much like the U.S. Air Cavalry in Vietnam. I don't know of any combat paradrops in Afghanistan. I don't think they ever jumped out of planes using parachutes. I think they were entirely helicopter-dependent. If I'm wrong about that, because I haven't found any record of a paradrop in Afghanistan, let me know in the comments. The Soviet airborne units, therefore, used many of the same tactics as the U.S. airborne forces in Vietnam, you know, from the We Were Soldiers movie and stuff. Like all airborne forces, the VDV had high morale and esprit de corps, and they considered themselves an elite. And honestly, their performance in Afghanistan was pretty high. They justified this belief. The Soviet airborne forces in the 1980s were considerably higher quality than the Russian airborne forces that got so painfully curb-stomped in 2022 in Ukraine. Even more elite were the Spetsnaz. We discussed the Spetsnaz a bit in Part 1. Spetsnaz is a general term for special purpose troops. The Spetsnaz did undergo elite training, much like US or other Western special forces, but the focus of Spetsnaz forces wasn't the specialness of the operator, more the specialness of the task. The primary purpose of the Spetsnaz was reconnaissance, scouting, and infiltration, which was why the Army's Spetsnaz units fell under the GRU, the Military Intelligence Division. The GRU's rival service, the KGB, had its own Spetsnaz units, like the Grom and Zenit groups that stormed the Tajbek Palace in Storm 333. The KGB's premier Spetsnaz unit was Group Alpha, their dedicated anti-terrorism unit, the equivalent of the U.S. Delta Force. The GRU Spetsnaz, the Army Spetsnaz, were normally fielded in brigade strength, and you can think of their mission set as very similar to the Ranger Regiment in the modern U.S. Army, elite air mobile infantry for special missions. Do not think of these guys as modern special forces, with all their cool gear. You know, the GRU Spetsnaz didn't have specialized equipment or a bunch of high-tech gear. What they did have was special training, relaxed uniform standards, and a holier-than-thou attitude. So kind of like American special forces. They just weren't decked out in cool guy gear with a big bunch of big Viking beards. And unlike the U.S. Navy SEALs, they didn't write a bunch of books and hold a bunch of TED Talks about how awesome they were after losing the war. Ooh, was that a low blow? So that's a pretty decent look at the Soviet Army on the eve of the war in Afghanistan. Now we're going to talk about the units that actually went. When the Soviet leaders decided to invade Afghanistan, everything had to be scrambled on the fly. This meant suddenly activating a bunch of reserve units. This took place in the Central Asian republics because they were closest. So the initial Soviet force was largely composed of Central Asian reservists, most of whom, because of the ethnic bias of the Soviet army, had done their time in the special troops and had no combat training. Tanks were driven by guys who had never driven a tank before, infantrymen had barely fired a rifle during their time in service, all the units had to requisition civilian vehicles, trucks, and even taxicabs to make up for the lack of working vehicles in these reserve units. Many reservists couldn't be tracked down, others faked disabilities or ran away before the system could find them. Many of the officers were college students who had never served a day in the army. The sudden mobilization for the Afghanistan operation exposed the weaknesses of the decayed Soviet reserve system. Don't laugh too hard. This is probably exactly what would happen tomorrow if your random U.S. Army reserve unit got called up to go into war somewhere. You get to these motor pools, if 50% of the trucks work, you're doing really well. Unsurprisingly, these units performed poorly. Within a few months, the Central Asian reservists were replaced with professional officers and new conscripts, and the civilian vehicles with military ones. The main Soviet headquarters in Afghanistan throughout the war was the 40th Army. So the 40th Army, that is the Soviet unit in Afghanistan, the Soviet headquarters overseeing all the army units. By 1980, it had a strength of 81,000 men, with 600 tanks, 1,800 APCs, and 900 artillery pieces. It would reach its peak strength of almost 120,000 in 1986. The units that made up the 40th Army remained static throughout the war, even as the soldiers in those units came and went. This wasn't like the U.S. wars in Iraq or Afghanistan, where units went overseas as one unit and came back as one unit. This was more like the U.S. and Vietnam, where one unit would stay in place throughout the war, and the personnel in that unit would come and go. The 40th Army contained three motor rifle divisions and an airborne division, along with four independent motor rifle brigades and two independent airborne brigades that basically amounted to another two divisions. So about six divisions altogether. And this was a tiny fraction of the Soviet army. If you were a conscript in the 1980s, odds were that you would never go to Afghanistan. Your chances were higher if you were in the airborne or Spetsnaz units, which had much larger proportions of their units in Afghanistan and did their a larger share of the fighting, so they ended up getting a lot more need for replacements. The majority of airborne officers in the Soviet Army did an Afghanistan tour. Where were these units stationed? Well, I am going to have a map on my website laying out the main Soviet garrisons, which unit was where. But I'm going to walk you through it. The two original divisions that invaded Afghanistan on the ground were the 5th Guards Motor Rifle Division and the 108th Motor Rifle Division, or MRD for short. The 5th MRD spent the war in western Afghanistan with its headquarters at Shindan, south of Herat. The 108th MRD set up in Kabul itself, later moving to Bagram Air Base. The 201st MRD arrived in January 1980 and took responsibility for northern Afghanistan, headquarters at Kunduz. The four independent motor rifle units were the 66th Motor Rifle Brigade, stationed at Jalalabad, just up the Khyber Pass, the 70th Guards Motor Rifle Brigade, stationed at Kandahar in the south, the 191st Motor Rifle Regiment at Ghazni, and the 860th Motor Rifle Regiment at Faizabad, in the high mountains of Badakhshan in the northeast. The airborne units. The 103rd Guards Air Assault Division flew into Kabul Airport in December 1979 and participated in Storm 333. They remained at Kabul Airport throughout the war. The 345th Guards Parachute Assault Regiment was based at Bagram. Its 9th Company, led by Lieutenant Valery Vostrotin, had taken part in the storming of the Tajbek Palace. The 56th Guards Airborne Assault Brigade was originally stationed at Kunduz in northern Afghanistan. Later in the war, they moved to Gardez in eastern Afghanistan, when the Soviet strategy shifted to stopping Mujahideen supply convoys from crossing the Durand Line. There were also two Spetsnaz brigades sent to Afghanistan. The 15th and 22nd Spetsnaz brigades arrived in Afghanistan a couple years into the war. The 15th was at Jalalabad, while the 22nd was at Asadabad in the Kunar Valley. Both in eastern Afghanistan, in prime position to Attack Mujahideen supply convoys along the Durand Line. Maybe there's a reason I kept talking about the stupid Durand Line. The places where these units were stationed did not mean that was the only place these units were in combat. Units would be pulled from all these divisions into combat operations all over the country. Units were pulled from like 4 different divisions for some of the larger operations. So for the rest of this series, I will be constantly citing these units. I'll be like, Private So-and-so of the 191st Motor Rifle Brigade. You don't have to memorize them. There's no test. I'm just putting out the information. The 40th Army was unique among Soviet armies in that it had its own air force. By spring 1980, the Soviets had 500 helicopters and fixed-wing aircraft stationed at one of the major airfields, Bagram, Kabul, Kandahar, Kunduz, or Shendand. Unlike the U.S. military, Soviet helicopters were part of the Air Force. In the U.S., they're part of the Army. For the Soviets, helicopters were the critical piece of technology in Afghanistan. The Soviet helicopters were like icons of this war, just like American helicopters became icons of the Vietnam War. They were indispensable in Afghanistan's high mountains and primitive roads and broken terrain. There were lots of Soviet bases all over Afghanistan that could only be supplied by helicopter. The most famous Soviet helicopter was the Mi-24 attack helicopter, which Soviets called the Crocodile. Its NATO reporting name, like the name that all the Western and U.S. forces called it to, you know, call it out, hey, look, there's an X or a Y. When I was in the Army, I was trained to report this helicopter as a Hind. So I'm going to keep calling it the Hind. The Hind is a classic bad guy helicopter. This thing just looks evil. Like Darth Vader's helmet looks evil. The bubbles of its cockpit resemble bulging eyes, and its hooked wings and long tail make it look like a dragonfly. The Hind is a heavy attack helicopter with an arsenal of machine guns and cannons and big rocket pods. You'll see these things in like videos firing just like streams of rockets at their targets. It could also carry up to 8 troops. Compared to American helicopters, it has the combat capabilities of the Apache and the transport capabilities of the Black Hawk. The Mujahideen were terrified of the Hind. It was their least favorite thing. Hearing the thudding of a Hind helicopter off in the distance was like, oh shit, they're coming. It was incredibly dangerous and very difficult to kill. The Mujahideen called the Hind the Shaitan Arba, or Satan's Chariot. The other main Soviet helicopter was the Mi-8. The Soviets called it the Bumblebee. Its NATO reporting name is HIP. The HIP can be identified by the 2 bulbous air intakes over the cockpit. In typically crude U.S. military humor, my sergeant always used to tell me, hey, look for the 2 boobs over the cockpit. It's just, that's just soldiers, man. The HIP is a transport and utility helicopter that can carry 24 passengers. The HIP was the Soviet workhorse in Afghanistan. This was the helicopter used for air assaults or supply runs or medevacs. The U.S. equivalent would be the Chinook. This was the helicopter that all the airborne troops rode into battle. The Soviet Air Force also deployed fixed-wing aircraft to Afghanistan to support the ground forces. This included a variety of tactical bombers like the Su-17, Su-24, and Su-25. The Su-25 became the legendary ground support aircraft of the war, similar to the U.S. military's A-10. Su-25s carried out more missions than any other Soviet jet aircraft, strafing with its nose-mounted chain gun and dropping bombs on ground targets. There were also MiG-21 and later MiG-23 fighter jets, mostly used for ground attack missions, and occasionally playing chicken with fighter jets from the Iranian or Pakistani air forces. The Soviets did occasionally use heavy strategic bombers, like the Tu-16 or the Tu-22. Though these bombers flew from bases inside the Soviet Union and never actually deployed to Afghanistan. The Soviet command structure in Afghanistan was pretty janky. The 40th Army was technically subordinate to the Turkmenistan Military District back in Tashkent, which reported to the Chief of the General Staff in Moscow. But there was also an operational group commander in Afghanistan, and he reported directly to the defense minister, bypassing the general staff. Finally, there was the chief Soviet military advisor to the Afghan government, and he also reported to the defense minister, and also sometimes to the Soviet ambassador in Kabul. So you have three separate chains of command for Soviet forces in Afghanistan. Not great. The 40th Army went through seven different commanders, the first of which was General Yuri Tukhodinov, who led the original invasion, and the last of which was General Boris Gromov, who led the withdrawal in 1989. I'm not going to go through all seven commanders, they aren't that important. The highest-ranking Soviet officer in Afghanistan was always the Operational Group Commander. From 1979 to 1984, this was Marshal of the Soviet Union Sergei Sokolov, who planned the initial invasion and oversaw the first half of the war. He was succeeded by General Valentin Varenikov. Varenikov was a veteran, really a survivor of the Battle of Stalingrad, a fierce and outspoken commander, very controversial and never afraid to butt heads with his superiors. Sokolov and Varenikov will be the main Soviet generals we talk about throughout this series. They were the main commanders directing military operations in Afghanistan. The Soviet generals were pretty competent. They were rock-solid professionals with a strong sense of duty and honor and service pride. They were technically proficient and extremely skilled. Many of them had proven their courage and fighting ability in World War II. They were surprisingly well-studied in military history. Soviet military education always places a greater emphasis on military history than in the West, and up-to-date on modern military developments. And many of them had served as foreign advisors to other communist governments. So these guys should have been the best possible people to win the war in Afghanistan. But competent people do not always serve a competent institution. The Soviet Army had many good qualities, but was hamstrung by the rigid confines of doctrine and ideology. Let's tie all this together by talking about the Soviet way of war. We've talked about all the hardware, let's talk about the software. The Soviet Union won its last war, World War II, using a military doctrine often referred to as deep operations, the Soviet answer to Blitzkrieg. Deep operations involved enormous, carefully planned attacks to rupture an enemy's defenses, followed by huge mechanized forces to exploit the breakthrough and penetrate the rear areas. Deep operations emphasize mass, speed, synchronization, overwhelming firepower, and overwhelming numbers. This was the doctrine that destroyed the Nazi military and brought the Soviets to the gates of Berlin. If your picture of the Soviet army in World War II is still mainly comes from the movie Enemy at the Gates, throw that down the disposal. Do not underestimate the effectiveness of deep operations. The Soviets planned to use deep battle, deep operations, against the U.S. Army and its NATO allies in World War III. The slogan was 7 days to the Rhine. Airstrikes would cripple enemy command centers, and airborne VDV and Spetsnaz assaults would seize key objectives to pave the way for a torrent of motor rifle and tank divisions. The Soviets fully anticipated the use of nukes during this battle, so all their training involved NBC and hazmat gear. The deep battle doctrine rested on overwhelming force and firepower. The Soviet military always favors quantity over quality, mass over precision, brute force over finesse. Why waste time plotting artillery onto a single target when you can just wipe out the grid square? Why send a tank company when you can send a division? Why take casualties storming that village when you can level it with aircraft? There is no kill like overkill. The Soviets would use this sledgehammer approach in Afghanistan, with the consequences of enormous losses of civilian life in the process. The Soviets did not care about collateral damage. They don't care at all. And Soviet equipment was developed for this kind of war. What do all those weapons and vehicles I just described have in common? They're all cheap, simple, easy to mass produce, easy to use by the average conscript, and they spit out lots of destruction. The focus is on mass quantity, mass firepower, a mass conscript army. The weapons reflected the doctrine. The difficulty of deep battle and deep operations revolved around scale. To exercise command and control over a force this huge, to undertake operations this complex with a conscript army and keep everything functioning in a nuclear environment, you needed to keep things simple and predictable at the low level. Small units needed to carry out orders by the book, per doctrine, so they all fit perfectly into the grand design. So Soviet training emphasized very simple, very crude tactics, constantly repeated battle drills, repetitive training over and over and over in a single task. You'll see Soviet tactics that have your infantry platoon advancing on either side of their armored vehicle, standing straight up, just spraying the enemy position with automatic fire. You're not doing 3 to 5 second buddy rushes much. You're just glomming onto these guys. It was all the conscripts could handle with their low level of training, and all they needed to know. Soviet military training minimized the individual and stress cohesion, mass, synchronization, and unity. This inevitably meant sacrificing low-level initiative. Initiative was a liability. It might mess up the plan. Soviet lieutenants and captains and majors were not expected to make plans, but to implement the plans of their superiors. There was a textbook solution to every problem. Run into an enemy tank platoon? Flip your book open to solution D3. Air attack? Turn to solution A4. If the solution didn't work, you did it wrong. You had a cool idea, Lieutenant? You wanted to try something new? Why? Do what the book says. Soviet officers, junior officers, were not taught how to think, but what to think. This over-centralization of decision-making even extended to logistics. Most Western countries use a pull system of logistics, where the lower unit will request supplies and the higher unit makes sure they're delivered. But Soviet logistics use a push system, where the higher unit sent the supplies they thought the lower unit would need. The lower unit didn't have the opportunity to request supplies. This was simple, predictable, top-down logistics. It was easy to manage, but it was also clumsy, inefficient, and unresponsive to changing circumstances. Like the whole rest of the system. You can look at the Soviet logistics system as a microcosm for their entire economy and society. So deep battle was rigid, inflexible, a carefully controlled and top-down doctrine that emphasized large-scale planning and giant synchronized operations over creativity, low-level initiative, efficiency, or small unit tactics. A lot of this was sheer necessity. You have these poorly trained conscripts, this huge army, with the inevitable chaos and disruption of the nuclear battlefield you expect to fight on. It's just the best way to fight with the military you have. But there was a deeper reason to the Soviet way of war, and this lay in Soviet ideology. Marxism-Leninism portrayed itself as objective, scientific, based on material truth and reason. An outgrowth of Marx's theories of historical and dialectical materialism, which saw history as the product of changes in material conditions that caused societal evolution. Not the product, history is not beliefs and cultures and individual choice. History was not the story of the individual, but changes in material conditions and how the collective reacted to them. Understand the material conditions, you understand scientifically how people will react to events, and now you can discover objective truths in history and sociology and in military affairs. The Soviets built their entire system off this philosophical assumption. The politics, the economy, the society, the culture, the art, all built around scientific socialism. There was an objective solution to everything. And this applied to war. The Soviets viewed war not as an art, but as a science, fundamentally, with objective rules and variables that could be discovered and quantified. Soviet officers studied military science and military history. Soviet tactics revolved around a playbook of logical, objectively correct battle drills. Soviet manuals stated that if we apply X force against Y target will be defeated, not might be, will be defeated. Soviet operations were systematic, inflexible, and rigid because they were scientifically developed based on past experience, analysis of military history, and intense research by the general staff. This is the formula that will win World War III as long as you do it right. We will win objectively, scientifically, mathematically. So Soviet military doctrine reflected Soviet politics. It was bound by orthodoxy, by theory, by an ideologically limited view of the world and how it functioned. Inflexible, rigid, hidebound, convinced of its own infallibility even as it failed to produce results. It was a Marxist approach to warfare. I've made it clear in so many ways in this episode that a military is a reflection of the society that produces it. All the stuff I said about the Soviet economy and society in the last episode, if you'll notice, I just showed how it impacted the Soviet military. One of the biggest things that would hamstring the Soviets in Afghanistan was this inflexible and rigid doctrine. Soviet generals would routinely launch massive, carefully planned operations. The junior officers would carry out their roles in this performance, execute their by-the-book battle drills. Very few of them knew how to get creative, to improvise, or think on the fly because they hadn't been trained to. But Afghanistan wasn't a general's war. It was a platoon leader's, company commander's, battalion commander's war. It was a war of small skirmishes, of raids and ambushes, and platoons and companies fighting their lone separate battles on a convoy or in a valley or at an outpost. The low-level officers who had been taught what to think would have to learn how to think. Lots of them did. There were plenty of Soviet junior officers who found solutions and new ways to fight the Mujahideen. They weren't a hive mind. Many Soviet officers did adapt and evolve and learn new ways to fight the enemy. But a lot of them didn't. It would be very easy, based on what I've told you, to underestimate the Soviet way of war, especially if the Russian army you're used to seeing is Putin's army in the modern day. But do not judge the Soviet army of 1979 by the Russian army of 2022. This was an extremely professional, extremely dangerous opponent. This is the army and doctrine that destroyed the Wehrmacht and was designed purposely to defeat the US Army and its NATO allies in World War III. And guys, if that hypothetical battle had taken place in the 1980s on the North German plain, it's anybody's best guess who would have won. I don't know, and anyone who says they know is a liar. But if I had to place a bet on who would win that battle, I would probably lean slightly towards the Soviets. The Soviet military, like the Soviet economy, was like a charging grizzly bear. Yes, it was big. It was crude. No finesse, no subtlety, all mass and speed and power. But it's really hard to stop a charging grizzly bear. And the Soviet bear seemed unstoppable. It was mighty, terrifying, all those claws and teeth and force. But evolution had designed it for a singular environment and a singular foe. Put it in a different environment, give it a different enemy than the one it's evolved to fight, trap it in an inflexible ideological cage of its own making, and things aren't going to go so well. Which is what happened when the Soviet army, narrowly designed to fight one war really well, found itself fighting an entirely different one. And the bear would stumble. But socialist ideology had one final impact on the Soviet army. We've talked about this high-level conceptual stuff, but the Soviet army was made up of soldiers, of individuals, of people. And one thing I have been surprised to find in my research, and I find this constantly, is how many Soviet soldiers on their way to Afghanistan really believed in the cause of socialism, of liberating the Afghan people and protecting a fellow communist government from foreign invasion. Lots of these guys really believed they were coming to Afghanistan for a righteous, noble cause. They were true believers in the socialist dream. But don't take my word for it. Let's hear from an infantry private.
At our training camp, everyone knew we were being prepared for Afghanistan. One guy admitted he was scared we'd all be killed. I despised him. I thought he was mad. We were going to create a revolution, weren't we? That's what we were told, and we believed it. It was kind of romantic.
A lieutenant.
We were told over and over again that we were there to fight bandits, that we'd be heroes, and that everyone would be grateful to us. I remember the posters. Soldiers, let us strengthen our southern borders. Uphold the honor of your unit. Flourish Lenin's motherland. Glory to the Communist Party.
A medic.
I accepted the official line so completely that even now, after all I've read and heard, I still hope that our lives weren't entirely wasted. The political officer gave this lecture about the international situation. He told us that Soviet forces had forestalled the American Green Beret airborne invasion of Afghanistan by just 1 hour. It was so incessantly drummed into us that this was a sacred international duty that eventually we believed it.
A nurse.
We were told that this was a just war, that we were helping the Afghan people to put an end to feudalism and build a wonderful socialist society.
A battalion commander.
If we were sent to fight, that in itself meant that it was both just and necessary. I always made a point of personally explaining to my men how important the defense of our southern borders was. I gave them my own ideological grounding, you could say, in addition to their twice-weekly political education lectures. How could I admit to doubt?
Lieutenant Vladimir Polyakov was stationed in East Germany when he received orders for Afghanistan. His father offered to pull some strings and keep him out, but Polyakov wanted to go defend the peasants and workers of Afghanistan. He had heard rumors that the CIA was about to invade, and he wanted to help defend the socialist revolution. He told his father,
"You sent me to a military academy. I've been trained for war. And now when my country needs me, you want me to stay away?"
Again, it honestly shocks me. The sheer number of times I've read a Soviet soldier or civilian or official talking about their ideals and their beliefs and their hopes going into this war. How they really believed they were going to save the Afghan revolution, liberate the oppressed peoples, build a socialist paradise in a backwards country, and bring them into the modern world, flags waving, cheering and singing and so forth. Of course, what they found in Afghanistan was something much different. But maybe it shouldn't shock me. It's a tale as old as time. A story I've heard from Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans in my time. A story told by the Vietnam veterans in their time, generations and generations before us. And I guess all countries have their own version of the young people who go off to war, believing in what they were sent to do. Whether they come back still believing it is a different story. The Greek historian Thucydides, writing about the outbreak of the Peloponnesian War in 431 BC, recounted,
"There were many young men who were eager to take up arms, for they had never been in a battle."
So it has always been. So it was in 1979, when the bear stumbled into the graveyard of empires. Thanks for listening today. I hope you enjoyed this episode, this long overview of the Soviet Army on the eve of its war in Afghanistan. I'm putting out a lot of content, y'all, really making up for that hiatus. If you want to hear about more about the Soviet experience in Afghanistan, I will cover that in another short round down the road. That one's going to be called A Deployment to Afghanistan. It's going to be extremely bleak. If you like what you've heard today, please let people know and spread the word. If you want to know my sources or look at my maps for this series, including the map of where all the Soviet units in Afghanistan were stationed, they are on my website at unknownsoldierspodcast.com. If you want to contribute to my book fund, I have a donate button there as well. Easiest way to contact me is on the Facebook page or at unknownsoldierspodcast@gmail.com. Next time you hear from me, we will see the bear stumble into combat in Afghanistan. Soviet-Afghan War Part 2 will see the outbreak of the guerrilla war as the Soviets struggle to fight the Mujahideen. We will also get a good hard look at those Mujahideen. In particular, one commander who ended up being the Soviet Army's arch nemesis, Ahmad Shah Massoud, the Lion of Panjshir. So get ready for Episode 57, the Soviet-Afghan War Part 2, The Bear and the Lion, here on Unknown Soldiers.